coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
I think one of the main things that I said is definitely recruiting people from those communities to serve those communities. So we've been doing a lot of recruitment for therapists who are maybe outside of what you would see when you Googled psychedelic therapist. And on top of that, we're working on this research program to get really direct feedback from our clients so that they can say, hey, this works and that doesn't work. And really making sure that we're tracking, you know, like what is good, what isn't as good, what can we do better, and taking on this really client-centered approach in our therapy that's based on the relationship with the client and creating a sense of safety with the client before diving into the ketamine work, because the psychedelic work itself can bring up so much trauma and can be re-traumatizing if it's not and done in a safe container. So what we really focus on is establishing a safe relationship before introducing the drug into the equation too. And aside from that, in our training program, we introduce readings from a lot of people of color, and we end up looking at things through this lens of social justice instead of this like individualized white therapist approach.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts, presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. My guest today is Irina Alexander, co-founder of Sage Institute for Integrative Health, a new psychedelic-assisted therapy clinic and training center that prioritizes equal access to psychedelic therapy. On the show, we discuss the SAGE model, which provides access to psychedelic medicine for underserved communities, training for therapists from diverse backgrounds, and psychedelic research. We discuss SAGE's perspective on psychedelic ethics and how to orient oneself towards social justice. Finally, Irina explains the journey of recruiting SAGE interns, from community outreach in the Bay Area to how you, the listener, might apply to the next cohort. Applications are due on May 15th. Irina has a background in drug policy reform and harm reduction as chair of the Board of Students for Sensible Drug Policy and a supervisor in psychedelic peer support with the Zendo Project. She is also an adherence rater for MAPS Phase 3 MDMA clinical trials. She studied marriage and family therapy at University of San Francisco and is now a therapist at the Harm Reduction Therapy Center and at Sage Institute, which she co-founded. If psychedelic healing gives advantages in life, and it's only available to the most fortunate, then this powerful movement of healing might only serve to increase inequality. Sage is on a mission to make sure that doesn't happen. Hi, Irina. It's nice to see you.
Nice to see you too.
Have we seen each other in person since Costa Rica? Perhaps at Burning Man briefly? I can't recall.
Totally possible. It's really hard to tell with coronavirus time and space right now.
So you were a supervisor with the Zendo Project in 2015, and now you are one of the co-founders of Sage Institute, which is a model for access for psychedelic therapy. And the Institute sees patients who may have a barrier to entry around financial and cultural issues. But the Institute also is training therapists that are not typically involved in psychedelic therapy and doing innovative research. And I think it's one of the most interesting models out there, particularly when it comes to expanded access to psychedelic therapy. So I'm really thrilled to talk to you today and just get up to speed on what you're doing with Sage. And it's just nice to reconnect with you after a little while.
Yeah, likewise. I'm really excited to talk about Sage and to let you in on what's been going on in the past few years of my life.
So you started in drug policy reform and then ultimately came to psychedelic therapy. Can you talk to me a little bit about that journey?
Yeah, I got involved in drug policy reform pretty young with Students for Sensible Drug Policy back in about 2007. And got really involved in working on overdose prevention policies when I lived in D.C. And basically was just like, you know what, screw the drug war. This isn't fair or just that all these people are sitting behind bars, mostly people of color and lower income folks. and decided at that point to just dedicate the rest of my life to ending the drug war. Majored in criminology, criminal justice, Black women studies, and made my whole life about legalizing drugs at that point.
And where were you in school at that time?
I started at Virginia Tech and then ended up transferring to the University of Maryland.
So tell me how you got from working with drug policy reform into actual psychedelic therapy itself.
Yeah, so I worked for the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation for a year, working primarily on overdose prevention policy. And from there, started to realize that I actually really liked working with people. I started going on the streets and doing outreach work with this organization called HIPS in DC, which I have a very tender place for in my heart. And we would drive around an outreach van in the middle of the night and just talk to people on the streets who were doing sex work and using drugs and giving them a safe space to just like check in and talk to someone and get supplies for really basic needs like condoms and syringes and lemonade and candy. And I would go back to my office job in drug policy reform after that and talk to my supervisor about the night that I had out on an outreach van. And he was actually the first one to be like, you know what, Irina, you need to do this whole like direct service working with people one-on-one thing. So that was really what inspired my road down to the path of working with individuals. I started doing counseling with a youth outreach organization in San Francisco after that and did that for 7 years until last year when I shifted to becoming a therapist.
Where did you study to become a therapist?
I studied at the University of San Francisco. And, you know, the reason that I really ended up getting into psychedelic therapy, I think I should speak about that since that's what this whole thing is about, is I got involved in the festival scene in 2008, I believe, was my first Burning Man. And I went to Burning Man and had a really wild experience, you know, doing the whole out on the playa and finding myself and finding others like me, et cetera, as you know. But what I ran into there that really kind of turned my life around was the Zendo Project. And the thing that really excited me about the Zendo Project, for those of you who don't know, it's just this little setup of a harm reduction space for people who are having a hard emotional experience or psychedelic experience or other drug-related experience can go and sit down and really just be taken care of in a way that's really non-directive and supportive and meeting their needs. And the thing that really blew my mind about that was seeing a model of mental health support that didn't involve police. So I went to Burning Man my first year and saw that. And from that point on, got really involved with the Zendo Project and started volunteering and eventually became a supervisor and really continued in the festival scene just to work, to work and to really figure out how to replicate this model of mental health and emotional crisis support out in the outside world. I mean, we literally would have law enforcement like bring people to the Zendo Project instead of lock them up in cages, which is what we do outside of the privilege festival scene. And yeah, so I've been kind of on the path towards that since.
What was your first gig as a psychedelic therapist?
Well, I finished therapy school just last year. So if we're getting all technical on it, Sage Institute was my first gig. But with the Zendo Project, there was a lot of not guiding, but sitting with people. And through those experiences, I was just able to see how super transformative psychedelic medicines can be in people's journeys and in helping them process trauma and really get to know themselves and go through some really, really deep healing. So I think the work through Zendo was really what inspired me, as well as over the past, I think, year and a half, I've been an adherence rater for the MAPS-MDMA studies. So I watch the MDMA videos from the clinical trials and make sure that the therapists are kind of sticking to all of the adherence items throughout those.
What are the adherence items? What are some examples?
There are some adherence items that are a little more broad, like creating a safe container, you know, making sure that the client feels safe. And then there are other items that are really, really specific, like making sure that the client is drinking water during the session and stands up really slowly so they don't faint and fall over. So it really varies. And they're also different from prep session to experimental session to integrative session, and we just reference back a document with a bunch of different points. So yeah, some of it is really technical, and other parts of it are actually just like feedback from how we perceive the session to have gone.
And I wasn't aware that Sage was your first gig as a therapist. I think that's going to be quite inspiring for some of our listeners who are planning careers in psychedelic therapy, because what it sounds like you did essentially is you did your training, you were involved in the psychedelic community for a long time, and then you envisioned something that you felt the psychedelic community needed and that the world needed. And rather than go and try to find that in the world, you created it with some of your colleagues.
Yeah. And to clarify, actually, I did start a gig right before Sage. So I work at two jobs as a therapist right now. I work at the Harm Reduction Therapy Center, which is a mobile therapy program where we literally drive a van around in parts of San Francisco and set up the van as a little mobile therapy space where our clients can come in and just talk to therapists for free. Most of our clients are homeless or unstably housed and really low income. And we also have a massage therapist there, an acupuncturist, and we serve food to our clients. So really kind of bring all of the basic needs into one really accessible space. So this concept of accessibility is something that I really hold close to myself as a value for therapy. Especially therapy should not be a luxury. It should be something that everyone has access to.
And that definitely is one of the driving values of the Sage Institute. How did that come about? Were there others who had a similar idea and you sort of coalesced around? Did you meet at conferences? How did you get together to know that this was the group of people you wanted to start something new with?
So all of us had been friends already. Just we have this little core group of staff members that got together. And Genesee is one of the people who initially started Sage Integrative Health, which is kind of our sister organization for people who have more money and are able to do this integrative work with acupuncturists and massage therapists and nutritionists and also therapists. But Genesee, I actually met at a MAPS conference where I was sitting next to her in one random session that we were both at, and I introduced myself to her really shortly, and then she ended up leaving, and I ran down the hall. I just sprinted after her and was like, wait, we need to be friends. And from that point on, we became friends. So we've been friends for quite a while. And Genesee, along with a couple of her relatives, actually got together over the summer and included me and included another one of our staff members, Des. And all of us together just really put this vision into action and really made it happen. We're just like, all right, this doesn't exist. Let's just do it.
And so let's talk about what Sage Institute is. So at this moment, it is a ketamine-assisted therapy clinic that has a training program for psychedelic therapist interns and is also conducting or is soon to conduct research around the efficacy of psychedelic therapy. And as I understand, particularly as it regards to certain communities that don't typically have access. Is that an accurate broad stroke of Sage Institute?
Yeah, the three components that we look at are the training aspect, the therapy aspect, and then the research. So those are our three kind of main goals. With the therapy itself, we are doing some ketamine-assisted therapy. Right now, it's kind of on pause because of coronavirus, but we're also doing just some long-term depth psychotherapy work. So not all of our clients will be accessing ketamine therapy, but moving forward, most of them probably will, and hopefully it'll expand beyond ketamine therapy once more psychedelics are legally available. We also do some psychedelic integration work too.
And one of the core values is to create a model that offers a financially accessible clinic. I'm curious, how do you structure the organization so that you're able to provide access? Do people have a smaller amount that they pay? Are people sponsored by other people? How do you make this model, in terms of the financial accessibility itself, how do you make that work at this stage in the game?
So that's definitely been one of our main areas of struggle, is the financial aspect of it, both because we're bringing on therapists who are from diverse communities and they need money to do the work. and are bringing on clients who don't have money to pay for the therapy. So we kind of need money on both sides of the equation. And that gets really challenging. But one of the things that we are going to do is starting probably within the next year or so, depending on coronavirus stuff, is we will start a ketamine training program so that people who are licensed can actually get trained and pay us money for that. And we also have bit by bit started taking on just a couple of higher paying clients every once in a while to help balance things out a little financially.
And are there any, is there any institutional support that you're getting, any kind of like grants or any support from any kind of wealthy donors, or has this mainly just been bootstrapped and you're kind of figuring out the model as you go?
Yeah, so we've gotten some incredible donations. We've been super, super grateful for the people who have contributed to this work because we've kind of, we literally started with nothing. So the River Styx Foundation has been great. The Oren Fund, Dr. Bronner's even pitched in some money. And Crystal and Joe Peterson are two of our big donors. And we've also been really lucky to have the fiscal sponsorship of the Women's Visionary Congress throughout this time while we're applying for our 501c3 status.
And outside of just the actual money that ketamine therapy costs, what are some of the other barriers to entry for underserved communities to access this kind of treatment?
Yeah, so there are a lot of barriers to access. One of the barriers being people trying to find therapists that they feel comfortable with. And a lot of times that means therapists that look like them, therapists that have had lives that are similar to theirs, therapists with shared identities. So that's one of the areas that we're really trying to push the envelope in, is trying to shift who is represented in the psychedelic therapy field, because you look at most events, most talks, most websites, and most of the people on there are white people who are more privileged, a lot of them hetero and cis, and aren't representative of the folks that we're actually serving. So that's one of the kind of biggest areas, I think, for access. Aside from that, the way that our society has used drugs to oppress different communities is a horrifying problem. I mean, if you think about it, drugs have been used in our society to put people in cages. Like, literally, the war on drugs is just an extension of Jim Crow. And about 80% of the federal prison population is Black or Latinx, which is absolutely absurd considering that those folks are a minority in our country. Aside from that, drugs, you know, with psychiatry are constantly used to shut people up, to control people's minds, to pathologize them, and to systematically oppress groups of people who society doesn't want speaking up or speaking out. And, you know, not to mention the really traumatizing history of drug studies that have been done on marginalized groups, like the Tuskegee trials, and how Black men were just left to die from syphilis, like literally just to die, you know, and that was run by the federal government, you know, and on top of that, too, is just the criminalization of sacred medicine and indigenous communities. So basically all of these marginalized groups that I've identified have no reason to trust any sort of drug study, drug trial, drug treatment, because the way that drugs have been used have been in our society only used to suppress them and take away their power and not actually empower them and provide healing.
Mm. And so what makes SAGE different in this regard? How are you creating that trust with these communities?
Yeah, I think one of the main things that I said is definitely recruiting people from those communities to serve those communities. So we've been doing a lot of recruitment for therapists who are maybe outside of what you would see when you Googled psychedelic therapist. And on top of that, we're working on this research program to get really direct feedback from our clients so that they can say, hey, this works and that doesn't work. And really making sure that we're tracking, you know, like what what is good, what isn't as good, what can we do better? And taking on this really client-centered approach in our therapy that's based on the relationship with the client and creating a sense of safety with the client before diving into the ketamine work. Because the psychedelic work itself can bring up so much trauma and can be re-traumatizing if it's not and done in a safe container. So what we really focus on is establishing a safe relationship before introducing the drug into the equation too. Yeah. And aside from that, in our training program, we introduce readings from a lot of people of color, and we end up looking at things through this lens of social justice instead of this like individualized white therapist approach.
Are any of the resources that you use publicly available? You say that there's a lot of readings that you provide in your training. Is there a list that we can access of those? Is that, I'm not sure that would be public at this point, but I imagine that would be a really powerful research for a therapist who's building their own practice to be able to read that material themselves and familiarize themselves.
Yeah, we don't have the list of our readings published anywhere because we also have a lot of different trainers come in and different workshops that are led by outside people. It's not just one person doing all of the trainings. But the article that a few of our staff members collaborated on called Blinded by the White is something that folks might want to check out.
And we'll have that linked in the show note. So as far as recruiting psychedelic practitioners, how has that been going? Are you seeing a lot of interest from these different communities of people who want to actually be psychedelic therapists themselves? And how do you conduct that outreach?
A lot of it is really word of mouth. It's like people who know people and who can vouch for them and trust them. There was a really big training that MAPS did for people of color. So a lot of our therapists ended up actually going to that and met other folks there. And on top of that, too, Jason, one of our staff members, is a professor. So he's recruited some people from different schools.
How do the identities of the co-founders and the leaders of Sage Institute dovetail with this program? Are there members of the leadership team who are from these different communities? And if not, what is being done to create that balance? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so like I was mentioning, the way that this all kind of got started was just a little group of mostly relatives plus a couple of friends getting together and really just throwing this all together and jump-starting it into action. So one of the things that we're working on right now is creating a more diverse core leadership. And we're doing that right now by recruiting board members who are from more diverse populations. We actually have our first board meeting tomorrow. And yeah, I think one of the things that I can say is the majority of our staff is queer, and we have a variety of different lived experiences, but the area in which we could definitely use the most growth is more leadership from people of color.
And you talked about this third pillar being the research itself. Have you started conducting any research at the Institute at this stage? And if not, what research is proposed and how will you be conducting it?
We haven't actually launched the research program yet. Right now, we're just collecting information about how to do that research in a way that's not just ethical, but also gives back to the communities that participate, both financially and also just in the process of being able to share their input, share their feedback, and, you know, be given a voice, voices to people who don't usually have a voice in society. So we're really early on in the stages of all of that, but trying to do that to both help reinforce our program being as supportive as possible to folks in diverse populations, because this is a new thing and we want to make sure that we're doing it right, but also in a way that actually gives back to the communities that we're supporting.
I'd like to go a little deeper now into the philosophy of psychedelic ethics and issues around commercialization of psychedelic medicine. Something that was brought up to me in the context of Sage Institute by a woman I met on a retreat who was the first person who actually brought this up to me before I knew that you were working, that you had co-founded this organization, was this idea that if psychedelics are such powerful technologies of the self, that by their use, we can really accelerate our personal growth and our wellness. If they're also expensive and only available to those who are already very privileged, then psychedelic medicine would actually only exacerbate the growing inequality in this country. And that the very same people who are having access to the highest quality food and therefore have better health will have access to these incredible litany of technologies that will allow them to accelerate their spiritual growth and their mental wellness. And then others will be left behind. And I think that's one of the most poignant indictments of what's going on in the commercialization of psychedelic medicine.
Yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head there. That's exactly why our institute was created, was to not just address individual trauma, but also to address societal trauma. And what we need to do as individuals then, and as a training institute, is to recognize first off that we live in a really sick society. Like, society as it is really broken and really unjust, and allows for things like ripping parents away from children and throwing them behind bars for what they decided to put in their bodies, you know, or for survival, like because they were just trying to survive and get by, or because they were trying to have fun. Or it's really, really infected the way that our world is. So in order for us to not then just replicate those same systems that we're taught to obey and that we're taught are just kind of the norms of life, you know, things like racism and sexism and ableism and heteronormativity, like all of these things, we're trained daily, consciously and subconsciously, to kind of like reinforce and follow. And if we don't do our own individual work, then we're just going to take those same systems and replicate them in the work with our clients. And that just re-traumatizes people. That doesn't actually create a space for healing. That just says like, oh, let's open up your psyche with this mind-altering substance and shove more trauma in there. So I think what you're speaking to is a lot. And really, that's kind of the reason that I got jaded with the psychedelic therapy movement, was just seeing these potentially really healing tools that within a relational context can be used to create a lot of trauma healing. I just kept seeing them replicated, you know, to be used with folks who have more privilege and more money and can afford $5,000 therapy sessions. And that really just repeats the same cycles that we're trying to work against.
I think most people listening are familiar with the beautiful graphic novel, We Will Call It Paula. If you are not familiar with this, it's a wonderful read and it'll be listed in the show notes. And basically, it's a fictionalized account of someone who started a psychedelic therapy clinic, got venture funding, and proceeded to see the clinic become commercialized in a way that was out of integrity with her values and slowly slip away from her. And when that story was published, it caused a lot of ripples in the psychedelic community around what models are being created. So my question here is, what are the structures that SAGE has in place as an organization to maintain the integrity of its values?
So one of our staff members was actually one of the people who wrote that, funny enough. But yeah, we have, the biggest thing I'd say is our focus on relational depth psychotherapy. So our focus on not just you're going to come into a clinic, take a drug and leave and use some sort of phone app to integrate your experience with a robot while tracking your feelings over the next 2 weeks. That's kind of our fear, is that the relational aspect of psychotherapy will just be stripped away, and all that ketamine-assisted psychotherapy will become will just be a ketamine prescription that you just take home and do, and that's it. But the way that we really envision it is that it's the relationship that is the healing aspect of it, and creating that relational safety that provides the healing space. So one of the ways that we really stick to making sure that that's happening is for people who don't have an ongoing therapist to come in to do ketamine-assisted therapy work with us, we require that they see a therapist weekly for at least 3 months before we even consider ketamine work with them. So we really say like, hey, we really want to get to know you. We want this space to be as safe as possible for you before we start diving into some really potentially deep and scary stuff. And we want to like work together collaboratively to assess whether or not ketamine is even right for you.
So Sage is really focused on this relational model. And I'm curious what the actual procession of the ketamine-assisted therapy looks like. The preparation, the therapy itself, and the integration. So what is the Sage model for ketamine-assisted therapy?
So first off, since we do focus on the relationship, the way that we end up going through a ketamine treatment looks really different for each individual. But to give you an idea, it looks a little different if someone has an ongoing therapist outside of Sage. If they do, then we collaborate really closely with that person's therapist and check in with them, ask them why they think this person would be good for ketamine therapy. And throughout the process, we end up working really closely with them, like reporting back and making sure that the ketamine therapy is just an adjunct to their ongoing therapy process. In cases where people don't have an ongoing therapist outside of Sage, so it's 3 months of weekly prep sessions, and then eventually they'll have a psych evaluation with our psychiatrist. If at that point, collaboratively, we all decide like, yes, ketamine therapy seems to be a good option for this person. And after that, if the psychiatrist does approve them, they get lozenges, ketamine lozenges, delivered to their front doorstep, to their house, which is quite strange. And they bring those lozenges into the session where they then self-administer them. So the self-administration of those lozenges actually makes the services more financially accessible because we don't need a medical provider there actually administering it. The ketamine session itself is about 3 hours long. That's pretty intensive therapy work. And afterwards, we have at least 2 integrative sessions, sometimes more. Sometimes a person will be like, you know what, I need like 2 months of integration work before diving back into ketamine. And that's the point at which we really kind of alter it based on each individual's needs. After that integration period, they then go into another ketamine session and repeat that for at least 3 cycles. We ask that people for whom ketamine ends up working as a good ally, that they commit to doing at least 3 rounds of it to see whether or not it's actually helping them with their symptoms. And throughout the whole process, we're doing a lot of deep integration work and prepping for the upcoming one. So that's the way in which we really don't make it this like, you know, kind of cycling through the door sort of ketamine work. And we actually focus on like slowing it down and doing the work, because a lot of the work is in the integration. It's not actually in the ketamine session. There are a lot of people on our wait list right now, actually over 80 at the moment, and it's going to take us a while to get through them, which is one of the downsides. But we're really, really holding at our core that the relationship that we have with each individual client needs to be at the forefront, because ketamine is not just some sort of magic pill. It's not something that someone can just take and feel better. In fact, a lot of times people take ketamine and feel a lot worse. And without that container of the relationship, that can just be, really damaging.
And something that just came into my mind as you were speaking is, with these 80 people on this wait list, do you means test the people who might be coming into the clinic? If you're providing this access for people who have barriers to entry, how do you assure that someone who just would like to have ketamine therapy and not pay $500, they don't just come to you? Or is there any barrier to that? Do you just want to welcome everyone? I'm curious how that works.
A lot of times people who have access to money won't want to wait on a wait list of 80 some people. There are other ketamine assisted therapy places right now, including Sage Integrative Health. So we usually, when someone sends in an intake form, they'll say what their monthly income is, and we'll just let them know like, hey, there's actually something probably more available for you right now instead of having to wait for a really long time.
Are the two organizations, are they linked? I mean, is it a sister organization that's separately owned, or do you share resources? How do the two organizations intersect?
Right now, legally, they do not. The only big intersection is Genesee, who is a founder of both. So they don't officially overlap. Sage Institute is applying for a 501c3 status, and it's kind of a separate thing at the moment. But we do very informally sometimes send clients from one to the other. If someone reaches out to Sage Integrative Health for ketamine therapy and says, oh, I only make $500 a month, then they'll kind of be sent over to the Sage Institute waitlist and vice versa.
And continuing this theme of the challenges around commercialization, one of the issues that comes up a lot when we talk about the commercialization of psychedelics is this kind of capitalist competition where people are not sharing the resources that they've developed. How does Sage view the issue of competition in the marketplace with psychedelics?
Well, first off, in terms of clinics like ours, we're really, really, really supportive of more of those clinics opening up. The need is so clearly there, and we want more sliding scale psychedelic therapy clinics that are like really social justice oriented and really focused on relationship and really do the work of doing the right types of training. We really want more of those to exist because people could really use them. In terms of the kind of capitalist competition of, you know, envisioning this world very soon where people are going to have ketamine phone apps instead of therapy, I mean, I think the biggest thing we can do, especially since, you know, eventually I'd imagine that those sort of services will be cheaper. You know, download a ketamine phone app for, I don't know, $15 a month instead of going to a psychedelic therapist. I think part of what we're really able to do is just really stick to our core, like the faith in the fact that our model really works and really helps people. And you know what, like there are medical models of ketamine assisted, or not ketamine assisted, just ketamine therapy right now that are already out in the world where people go to a doctor's office, hook up to an IV, sit there for a few hours and leave and have absolutely no integration, no therapeutic support. And there are people in this world that that works for. There are. With people who have deeper trauma histories and more extended depression and stuff to really work through, that's the type of material that having that container of a therapeutic relationship, like not only really could be good, but probably needs to be there in order for it to be safe and effective over a longer period of time. Because just taking ketamine in and of itself, you know, maybe it'll potentially make some people feel better for a short term, but you're not actually getting to the roots of the problem and digging deep to find out what's going on and what's coming up to be processed.
And you mentioned that at Sage, your hope is that this model is replicated and that many clinics start that have this model. Are you aware of anyone else that's doing what you're doing right now or experimenting with similar models?
Yeah, as far as I know, our executive director has been in conversation with a couple of different places. Just the two places that come to mind are Holos Foundation in Arkansas and Sauna in Colorado, which one of my friends is actually running. Shout out to Vilmarie.
And what are those models? Are they basically the same as Sage, or are they doing something slightly different? Are you aware of kind of what they're offering?
What I know is that those two places have started considering bringing interns in. So I think that's something that I actually haven't mentioned, is the way that we're able to provide sliding scale therapy at Sage is by bringing in interns who are accruing their hours still towards their licensure. So that's one of the things that makes it more accessible to folks.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because this podcast is for psychedelic therapists and those who aspire to be psychedelic therapists. So the model that you're talking about, where you are able to provide sliding scale by having intern practitioners, that's actually the model that I was first introduced to acupuncture in Oakland by when I was in my early 20s. And I actually was using acupuncture to help with depression, and I couldn't really afford it. But I went to, I can't remember what it was called, but it was a Chinese medicine school in Oakland, and I would be seen by different interns. And of course, you know, sometimes the needles hurt more than they should have because people were training. And I wonder if there are some issues around that in terms of psychedelic therapy for me, you know. But I found a practitioner that I loved there, a shout out to Jake Chin, who I then continued to see privately after that experience. So I've personally experienced that model of more affordable care with interns. And as I just pointed out, sometimes the needles hurt a little bit more than I think they should have. Do you have any issues like that in terms of providing psychedelic therapy through internships? Are there any issues around the skill level necessary to be able to handle these kinds of medicines?
I think first off, I want to speak to how problematic the internship model in the therapy world is to begin with, mostly from a financial aspect of people are expected to go to school, start working at a traineeship while they're in school, leave school, keep accruing their hours, still not get paid while they're paying off student loan debts. So that's something that we've at least started to address at Sage. You know, we're especially reflecting on the fact that since we're bringing in more diverse practitioners, we really need to be able to financially support them. So unfortunately, we weren't able to do that when we first launched, but we have been able to do that over the past couple of months, finally start paying our interns who are out of school. In terms of the quality control piece, I guess, quality assurance piece that you're talking about, that's really important to our work. And we do a lot of supervision. Everyone gets at least an hour of individual supervision and 2 hours of group supervision a week. We have hour and a half long trainings every week by different practitioners. And the ketamine training program itself is actually a pretty intensive process. So our therapists who started in September actually still haven't gotten certified as ketamine therapists. There are only a couple of us who are doing ketamine therapy because we were in a different round of ketamine therapy training and have been able to start this work. But most of the people have not yet completed the full circuit of the training. And we make a lot of loopholes because this type of work can be really vulnerable and can bring up a lot. And we want to make sure that the therapists who are doing it are ready to do it.
And for those who are listening who aspire to be psychedelic therapists, what is the process by which folks can apply to Sage's program? Are you taking new interns at this time? How does that work? Are you drawing them from particular schools like CIIS? And what kind of prerequisites are required to participate in the SAGE training?
So people can go to sageinst.org/training to find out more information about applying for a training program. The applications are due May 15th for the upcoming cohort, which starts in September. And the requirements are that people have at least a year of clinical experience before they start. So that's another way that we control for quality. It's not like the people that folks start working with at Sage are their first clients ever. It's that they already have at least a year of work under their belt before they start this. And aside from that, you know, definitely people from different marginalized communities are encouraged to apply, especially people of color. And people who really thought about their own identity and how it relates to the world and all of the intersectionalities of all their different aspects of themselves and how that impacts their role as a therapist in relation to their clients.
I imagine there are a lot of people listening who don't live in the Bay Area, perhaps have started their own practice in psychedelic medicine. For the folks listening who are concerned about access to psychedelics, concerned about the commercialization of psychedelics and the way that access to psychedelic therapy can actually exacerbate issues of inequality, let's talk a little bit about how those folks can learn from the SAGE model and actually bring some of what you've discovered in working with SAGE into their own practices or the ways that they're thinking about their practice.
I mean, this is pretty basic, but I think offering a sliding scale model is really useful. One thing that we're actually doing is we're collecting funds for a reparations fund for Black and Indigenous people of color so that they can get even lower income sliding scale prices, so like $15 a session down to that. And really like financially making it accessible. I know it's hard at times to be like, oh, well, there's this one person who contacted me who can pay $200 a session, or there's this person who can pay $15 a session. And yeah, like acknowledging that depending on your privilege and depending on your ability, that there may be times when accepting the $15 a session person is something that really needs to be done for society. And also not treating that $15 per session person any differently than you would treat the $200 a session person. Aside from that, I think just continuing to do your individual work and recognizing any area of privilege that anyone has, continuing to really like reflect on yourself and cultivate a community of other people who can challenge you and challenge your kind of ingrained thinking patterns and keep pushing you to do that deeper work. You know, things like reading books about privilege, Me and White Supremacy for folks who are white is a good one to start with. Yeah, you know, diversifying the intake, like diversifying your like media intake, diversifying the books that you read, the authors that you take in, the movies that you watch, you know, and like actually like checking like, oh, is this article that I'm reading, like, who is it written by? What's their background? Putting that into the context of everything that you do in life, and really questioning and judging a lot of the assumptions that you have and a lot of the stigma that you hold, which is a big part of, unfortunately, the psychedelic world, is stigma around other drug use. You know, there's this like psychedelic elitism that happens. And especially at my other job at Harm Reduction Therapy Center, I work with a lot of people who use a lot of drugs. And sometimes I've had really, really insightful, integrative conversations with my clients who've done a lot of speed the night before and discovered God and discovered themselves through it, you know, so for us to really like question a lot of our assumptions and continue doing that.
If it's easy to recall and kind of bring up, can you think back to any key moments in your life that facilitated your orientation towards social justice and towards this perspective that you have around, let me put it this way, you talked about challenging mindsets. Our blind spots and our cognitive biases are there not because we wish them to be there, but are there because we have not seen otherwise, or we're not consistently seeing otherwise. I'm wondering if you can think back to the moments in your life that brought some of these philosophical perspectives into your field and allowed you to say, oh, no, this is really what matters to me. These are my values.
I think one of my earlier experiences that's impacted my whole life is the fact that I was born in Russia and moved with my family when I was 5 years old. So I started going to school in America, not knowing any English. And went to kindergarten just speaking Russian, and no one understood me, and I was kind of the outsider. And I think that established something for me in terms of first off, seeing how my parents were treated, having accents and not speaking English as well as everyone around them, and kind of, you know, really seeing the xenophobia of that experience of people just not being open to different cultures in America, even though we're supposed to be this like melting pot of cultures. And I think that growing up in an immigrant household, I just internalized that like people are different, you know, and everyone's different and everyone should have access to the same things. And like, to be seen as an outsider in a world is really challenging, and to be targeted or stigmatized due to your identity is something that early on I got to experience, but then later recognized like, oh, but I still only had the framework of like a white immigrant child. And there are so many other vastly different experiences and so many people with so much less privilege than I grew up in who experience the world through a completely different lens and have to navigate this constant stigmatization and marginalization through all of the forces in society, just like on a day to day, you know, like for me, like I ended up not having an accent when I speak English. My parents still have an accent, but that's kind of an identity that I have the privilege of like slipping out of. And I can just be like, oh, I'm just an American person. Look at that, you know, until I like speak Russian with my family. And then suddenly that's noticed. But other people living in our society have identities that are more visible, you know, identities that they can't like take on and off. And the way that society treats them based on those identities is so often through criminalization that at times, like, I mean, leads to the death of many groups of people. So I think that like that initial perspective, like moving to America at a young age in an immigrant family really kind of helped set the stage for me.
This makes me think of something that I really love about psychedelics and something that is really present for me in the conversation about commercialization and about psychedelic medicine generally, which is that psychedelics are by their very nature socially subversive. that are politically subversive, pardon me. Part of the healing that they do is not simply the neurochemistry of the mind, but also how we experience society. And my belief is that the more people who do psychedelics, the more leverage we have to start changing society to the more open-hearted experience we have during psychedelic therapy. So, you know, I think what's so important, and I'm so grateful that Sage is doing this, is actually conducting business in the spirit of psychedelics. You know, Sage to me seems like a very psychedelic organization because of the very way that psychedelics shows that we are all one. And it breaks down those barriers between me and what I perceive as the other. And so I think that we run a risk on the other side by having these really commercialized, really limited psychedelic containers that are meant to perhaps make the client more amenable to an unhealthy world, as opposed to psychedelic therapy that's really in the spirit of what I think psychedelics do most broadly, which is inspire us to change the world.
Yeah, I think a lot of that goes back to set and setting for sure. And yeah, I think that while a lot of times that's one of the beautiful, impactful, I mean, that's why psychedelic therapy is such a potentially remarkable source of healing, is this potential power that each of these medicines have. And it's not the right medicine for everyone. So that's something that we're also holding in mind. You know, it's not like, oh, if you take this substance, then suddenly like your heart's going to open and you're going to have this brilliant oneness with God and reality and so and so. So I think that although there is some potential for those substances for some people, that we also shouldn't say like, you know, it's like this heart opening experience for everyone. And if only Trump did acid, then the world would be a better place.
So I'd just like to finish today with giving you the opportunity, if you so desire, to speak directly to the psychedelic therapist or aspiring psychedelic therapist who's listening to this podcast. They've been with us for an hour now, and they've learned a lot about Sage, they've learned about you, and we've spoken a lot about access to psychedelic medicine and why that's so important. In these last moments, I would love for you to speak directly to our audience and offer, it doesn't even need to be on the themes that we're talking about, but really any feedback, any inspiration, any ideas around psychedelic therapy that you feel that our listener would really value hearing right now.
Yeah, I think that I would say, hey, psychedelic therapist. I would probably say, first off, let's take away the psychedelic part of psychedelic therapists and let's remember why you became a therapist. Psychedelics are a great little tool to use sometimes for some people, but if you really remember why you became a therapist, it was probably to make people feel less pain and to create more joy in the world and to create more healing. So if you start with that, you can't just think of healing on an individual level, at least not in our society. If our society was a perfect, bubbly, happy place where everyone had rights and access to healing, then sure, maybe it would be different. But because our society is broken, we need to really think about the healing work that we're doing in general, but especially with the amplifying tool of psychedelics, because psychedelics can just kind of like amplify whatever's already there. And if you're planning on doing work with this sort of amplification process, you need to really do your own inner work before your own stuff is amplified and put onto this other person who you build this close relationship with. So yeah, I would just say like really keep doing your own inner work, really keep thinking about things from a societal perspective and what role you're playing with it in it and what identities of yours are coming up in the relational context. And don't buy into this whole commercialization model of, yes, you know, you can pay for this dose of whatever drug and it'll make you feel better, because we all know deep down inside that the times when we've actually felt better have been when we've had a person there to hold our hand when we're struggling, and when we actually have connection to others. So I think that's what I'd say.
Thank you. Well, Irina, thank you so much for sharing your heart and your wisdom and for all the work you're doing at Sage. And just to finish today, how can the listener support you and how can they support Sage Institute?
Well, as I mentioned before, our biggest area of struggle is the financial aspect. So if people go to sageinst.org/contribute, you can find different ways to donate. Or if you have Venmo, you can Venmo right this second to SageInst.
And we'll have that in the show notes. And are you on all the social medias? Is there any particular channel that you'd encourage people to follow Sage to learn more about what you're doing and get more information?
We do have a Facebook account. We also have a MailChimp that people can sign up for on our website. And we are currently in the process of making an Instagram. So we're going to be really hip and cool soon.
Well, thanks again for this time today. And I appreciate everything you shared.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed this show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.